One of the things that I've learned from personal experience is that when your mom passes, Mother's Day becomes a very bittersweet kind of experience. This is the third Mother's Day now that my family is journeying through without my mom. And I continue to be grateful to God for the gift of her life, for the privilege of being her son. It's a day that my siblings and I will kind of have a time to share some stories about mom as a way to remember her and to celebrate her life. And I know I've shared a few stories with you before. Many of you knew my mom. She often came to Geneva when she was in town visiting. She often would try to get out here at least twice a year to see her family, to see her grandkids, to see me and Jennifer. And I know I've probably shared the story before, but it's one of my favorite stories about my mom. It kind of helps to show that she was a person who was small in stature. She's like 5'3", 110 pounds or so. But God packed into her a double portion of what I would call feistiness, energy. And especially if she got angry, she was a formidable person to be dealing with. And nothing tended to get her going more than when she thought that her kids weren't being treated fairly. Didn't matter whether you were 2 or 20. She would let that be known. So I know I share the story, but it's one of my favorite stories to share, so I hope you don't mind me sharing it again. But when I was about 20, I was home for the weekend to visit my family, to visit Jennifer, whom I was dating, and stopped at my parents' house and decided to go to the store. When I went to the store in my car, I left my wallet in my parents' house, turned around to go back and get it, and when I got back to the beginning of my parents' street, my brother was coming from the other direction, and we kind of arrived at the entry to that street at the same time. And sibling rivalry being what it was, we kind of looked at each other, smiled, and we both gunned it to kind of race up my parents' street. And we had lived there 10 years. I had never seen a policeman on that street. And so I was kind of shocked when I rode by and saw the policeman just sitting at the side of the street watching us go by. The lights go on, he does a U-turn, comes after us, my brother runs into the house, and so I was left to face the music out there by myself. And the policeman asked me for my license, and I said, well, it's in the house, can I go get it? He said, no, I'm not letting you out of my sight. I thought, really? Wow, okay. So my mom comes out of the house, my brother must have shared what was going on. And so I asked her to get my license, and she says, well, can't you get it? And I said, no, the policeman won't let me out of his sight. That's ridiculous, she says. So he walks up to the policeman, where do you think he's going to go? Ma'am, I'm not letting your son out of my sight. She gets closer to him. Don't you have something more important to do, like catching murderers and rapists and that hassling my son? I said, Mom, please, just go get my license. So I was happy that she was now angry at him instead of me. That was a blessing, but her intervention did not do me any favors. I still got a ticket that day. But you know, moms tend to try to have their kids' backs, you know, to try to do what they think is best for them. Which is also the case of a mom in this morning's scripture reading. She ends up advocating for her sons and approaches somebody who has a lot more authority than a policeman. Listen now for God's word to you as I share a portion of this story captured from the Gospel of Matthew. The mother of Zebedee's sons came to Jesus with her sons and kneeling down asked a favor of him. What is it you want? He asked. She said, grant that one of these two sons of mine may sit at your right and the other at your left in your kingdom. You don't know what you're asking, Jesus said to them. Can you drink the cup I am going to drink? We can, they answered. Jesus said to them, you will indeed drink from my cup, but to sit at my right or left is not for me to grant. These places belong to those for whom they have been prepared by my Father. When the ten heard about this, they were indignant with the two brothers, probably because they wished they had asked for that first. Jesus called them together and said, "You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be your slave. Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many." Well, right after this morning's message, we're going to invite a couple of folks to come up to be ordained as elders in our church. Now, we Presbyterians tend to do things in a very deliberative process. We are very systematic. Decently and in order is our motto. And so these elder electees have been through a rather extensive preparation time. They were first nominated for this office by a committee back in November or December. And following their nomination, they appeared before our governing board, the session. They were examined about their faith. The session gave them a stamp of approval. They came to the congregation late January, were elected by the congregation to be elders. But between that date and late January and today, they've been through a three-month orientation process. They've been invited to come to meetings of the session. They've met with the person they're replacing on that board. We've gone over the questions they'll be asked today, just to try to make sure they really understand what they're getting themselves into in taking this step. So that three-month period comes to an end today. Today, they take the reins of power and become part of this church's governing board. Now, when we hear from Jesus and the disciples in Matthew 20, they are near the end, not of a three-month, but a three-year preparation process. Christ has been his own nominating committee. He's gone around, he's picked 12 people to be his disciples. And what he wants to do is to shape these 12 men to be ready to take the reins of power once he no longer is on the scene. Now, these 12 aren't just invited to sit in on meetings and go over polity. He has spent virtually every moment of these 3 years with these 12. They've traveled together. They've eaten together. They've heard him preach. They've watched him teach. They've seen him perform miracles. They've been there when he's dealt with his critics and his opponents. He's shared with them kind of intimate knowledge of what the kingdom is like. He's poured all he has for 3 years into these 12. And you might think that after 3 years of this continual tutoring by Christ, they would be ready, prepared to take over the reins of power. But if you thought that, you would be dead wrong. The disciples here we're talking about. And instead of the 12 disciples, Christ seems to have assembled 12 stooges. They just do not seem to be able to figure out what he is really about. The beginning of the 21st chapter of Matthew, Christ enters Jerusalem for the last week of his life. So those last 8 chapters are devoted to the Last Supper, the crucifixion, the resurrection. And so here we are right at the end of the 3 years of training. The disciples have a chance to show that they get it, but they clearly don't. See, just prior to this passage, Jesus, for the third time now, has told the disciples, things are going to get really rough soon. Get ready. And here's what he says. We are going up to Jerusalem. And the Son of Man will be betrayed by the chief priests and the teachers of the law. They will condemn him to death and will turn him over to the Gentiles to be mocked, flogged, and crucified. On the third day, he will be raised to life. See, after we ask Dan and Glenn these questions of ordination, we're going to put our hands on them to bless them, to invite the Spirit to move through us to equip them for this work. Christ says to the disciples, when I get to Jerusalem, people will put hands on me, but it's not going to be to bless me. They're going to grab me, they're going to bind me, they're going to whip me, they're going to strip me, they're going to beat me, and they're going to crucify me. I want you to understand what's about to take place. Now, if one of your closest friends just told you that they were heading into a very dark, dangerous, and perhaps lethal time in their lives, you might respond to that friend's sharing by showing some degree of empathy. You might be concerned for them. You might shed a tear. You might do something to say, oh my gosh, that is terrible. What can I do? The disciples don't show any of that, because right after Jesus shares about what's happening to them, they get focused not on what's going to happen to them, but on what might be in it for them. They're angling for position. Now, the same story here happens in Mark. Now, in Mark, the disciples ask Jesus directly. Matthew says, well, the request comes through the mom. Scholars might think Matthew here is trying to protect the disciples a little bit, showing they're not quite that clueless. But Jesus responds to James and John, not to the mom. So clearly even Matthew is saying this is really about what the disciples themselves are wanting. We want to know that we'll have the two best seats at the banquet of glory. Go ahead and mark us down right now, one there and one next to your left. I mean, they would instantly have failed a pastoral care class at seminary for that response. Wow. Wow. 3 years of teaching, and this is what you do when you respond to Jesus' prediction of his own death. If you know the disciples, you know this is not an isolated case. This happens over and over throughout the Gospels. At one point, Jesus gets so frustrated with them, he finally says to them, how long must I put up with you? How long, God, will you make me be with these people? Oy vey, come on, this is enough. Another point when they don't get it, he says, are you so dull? Yep. Yeah, we are. It's kind of the response they show in this passage. We just don't get it. As I was thinking about the disciples' repeated failings to get what Jesus is trying to tell them, I was thinking about a time in Detroit Lions history when they just lost another ugly game to the Philadelphia Eagles. And Bobby Ross, the coach back then, was in a post-game interview. And he said these words. He says, that was terrible what we did out there today. We shot ourselves in that last drive. We got two holding penalties, a motion penalty. You think I coach that stuff? I don't coach that stuff. I work on that stuff. I spend time on that stuff. They got to step up and start making plays. I'm tired of taking it on myself. I mean, disciples show here, they're the Detroit Lions of disciples, you know. Over and over and over again, they shoot themselves in the foot. The problem is, though, they're not just doing holding penalties or motion penalties. They're not getting the very substance of the gospel. Their minds seem to be impervious to change, their brains to understanding. They're just not understanding what a coach far better than Bobby Ross has been doing with them. He's not trying to teach them how to block and run and catch. He's trying to teach them how to live. How to live from a kingdom perspective. I wouldn't have blamed Jesus here if he had gone off like Bobby Ross saying, you know, these guys, I'm tired of doing this by myself. They've got to step up. Start making plays. Start getting it. But instead, you know, he keeps on coaching them. Get them together in a huddle, 12 of them. He says, you know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them. And their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. You see, Jesus is living in a time when perhaps the height of human power in a single pair of hands is at its highest. Caesar is the emperor. And the coins that are being minted refer to him as the divine son. There's an emperor worship going on. He is being exalted, praised, adored by all the people. And he has place and power in certain parts of his kingdom, kings and prefects and governors. And all these folks are angling for position because they want that high place of authority. Why? Because they love the perks of power. It makes them somebody. They get the best seats at the banquet. They get to line their own pockets with taxpayer money. These folks like power. They like how it smells, how it feels. They don't want to let go of it. They fight for it. They kill for it. Herod himself killed his own family members to hold on to power. They like that place of authority. And in that rise to higher levels, they've lost sight of the people that they are called to serve. Can you imagine having officials who've lost sight of serving people? Can you connect with that idea today? People love power, position, prestige, the perks. And they forget that the people are the ones who are there to be served, not the other way around. Sometimes you get into authority and think the people are there to protect you, to serve you, to honor you. But that's not the way God intends it. So he says to the disciples, that's the way it works in the world, but not so with you. I've got a different paradigm, a different mindset I want you to really grab hold of and internalize. And here it is. Whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant. And whoever wants to be first must be your slave. Wow. You see, the world says it's all about wealth, prestige, power, and Christ says it's not about any of that. How the world stamps greatness onto people, that stamp has no use in God's kingdom. The world says that great people are remembered centuries later. They get their names put on the sides of buildings. They get monuments built to them. But in the kingdom, that's not at all how greatness gets defined. Greatness gets defined singularly and primarily through the reality of being a servant. It's not about what you amass. It's about what you give. It's not about what you get, it's about what you release into other people's lives. And here's the ironic thing. If you're worried about being great, you are far from the kingdom's understanding of what real greatness is. Truly great people in God's eyes aren't concerned about being great. They're not concerned about their own standing, reputation, prestige. All they are thinking about is how do I allow my life to be a blessing to other people. They're not self-focused at all. They have the eyes of God and they see where there is need to be met and they move out in action to address that need. No matter what the personal cost might be. If you want to be great, and that's really your angle, says Jesus, don't worry about where you are going to sit at this banquet. Spend your lives right now being servants. Do what I do. Have you been watching me? Do you see that I am somebody who has spent my life serving other people? What I'm trying to tell you is that being a servant for me will require not just giving of my time and my energy, but of my very life. I will be a servant to the point of death. So Paul said in that earlier scripture that Cindy read, Paul lays out for us, Christ had the highest level. He was God, above Caesar. But he did not count that position as something to grasp on to fight for. He let it go. He became human. And as a human, he didn't become a king, he became a servant. And as a servant, he was willing to die. And to die even on a cross. Paul narrates this downward mobility of the eternal Son. From a place of absolute glory to a place of humiliation on the cross, Jesus walked this path of downward mobility, of ending up as a pure servant. And he's trying to say to his disciples, if you want to follow me, you've got to take those same stairs down. You're trying to climb up. Don't do that. Go down into a place of serving others. And when you do that, you will indeed be great in God's eyes. A hard lesson to learn. You know, many parts of the world are happy with the way the new Pope has begun to show some signs of what Christ is talking about, but the fact that it's such news tells us something. Oh my God, a Christian leader is showing signs of humility. Imagine that. The church always is meant to be like that. So James and John want glory. Christ says, look, become servants. Start there. And watch me, he says. See, Jesus goes somewhere with this that Bobby Ross never had to go. He says, the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. Watch me. And do the same. Now, those being ordained and installed here today are seeking to put Jesus' words into practice in this community of faith. See, ordination has sort of a ring of authority, doesn't it? To be ordained is kind of a heady thing, but really, in our system, being ordained means you are willing to take a step down into servanthood. It means you are committing to modeling the servant style of Christ himself. And see, we need folks to model that. That's why Christ is trying to shape these 12 people. We need to be able to see those principles in action, or else they stay purely philosophical. Oh, that's what it means to be a servant. Oh, it means you forgive people who have hurt you. It means that you show compassion, patience, generosity, even to those that you might struggle with. It means you're not concerned about your own reputation, prestige, and power. You're really concerned only about honoring and blessing other people. That's what it looks like. And slowly over time, we like disciples begin to get it. Oh, this is what being a Christian means. It's not about being right, being powerful, controlling the culture. It's about serving the way Jesus served. And when we begin to get that, we begin to move out of the church and we begin to have that same philosophy wherever we are. And when you start to do this in the way that Jesus does, it might cost you something. It might be painful. It might not earn you applause or appreciation at all, but condemnation, rejection. Just ask a woman named Martha Mullen. She was the Christian out in Virginia who felt God saying to her, something has to be done about burying that Boston terror suspect. His own faith community says, no, we don't want to take responsibility for burying him. The city in which he lived didn't want any place there for him to be buried. So some woman in Virginia hears God saying to her, you are the one that needs to deal with this. And so she begins to organize a way to bury the body of Tamerlan Zarnoff. A Christian woman decides to see to it that a Muslim bombing suspect is a proper burial. Now, in today's culture, do you think that was applauded by people? Do you think they appreciated her act of servanthood? They asked her a few days later how it's been. She said these words. She said, I can't pretend it's not difficult to be reviled and maligned. But Jesus said, love your enemies. Imagine the world and Jesus being at odds about how to respond to something. The world says, don't let that no good, you know, whatever be treated with respect. Let that body be disrespected forever. This woman said, you know, he'll deal with God face to face. It's only right to bury his body. Why do that? Why take that step? Why risk anything? Well, because Jesus said, love your enemies. Pray for those who hurt you. Be a servant. If you want to be great, be a slave to all. See, his ways and our ways still are at odds. And Luke seeks to find disciples who are willing to say, I'll do it. I'll make that choice. I'll take that step. I'll risk that. And in a world that is so divided and there's so much hostility, anger, division, what does it mean for folks to take that step? Maybe, just maybe that is the way the kingdom gets seen. The gospel advances. Hope is given. May God find among us today a willingness to respond to his call. To be servants to all. It is to this great God that we give all praise and honor and glory today and forevermore. Amen.
We hope that you enjoyed this message. If you have questions or would like to know more about Geneva Presbyterian Church, please visit our website at genevachurch.org or call the church office at 734-459-0013.